Thank you. I am Kathy Gowdy, alternate defense counsel for appellant Sarah Berry, Colorado 28436. I am here asking this panel to remand Ms. Berry's 35C for a hearing on the facts that she alleged in her motion. That's all we're asking for, is it to be remanded so that the facts can be heard in an evidentiary hearing. In this case, there are ugly facts that involve the murder. What was not brought in to any of the court record were the many mitigators, the many defenses, the many other views of this side of this case that Ms. Berry could have presented had her counsel, her trial counsel, investigated.
Let me ask you a question about that, if I may, Ms. Gowdy. You speak of mitigators, and I assume that the word mitigator normally has a connection to sentencing. Is your argument that the information that, for example, the doctor would have provided, the psychologist would have provided, is information that should have been presented to the prosecution for the purposes of negotiating a plea disposition, or what are you saying that it should have been evidence that should have been presented at trial?
I have a broader view of mitigators, and it comes from reviewing capital cases in which the mitigators are brought in when you start the case, so that the jury hears the mitigators. They hear the other side. They would also hear it in the penalty phase. But in my opinion in this case, in particular with the huge amount of press that this case had, she was never undemonized. There was nothing put forward whatsoever to show that hers was a crime of omission, of failing to intercede, and not a crime of doing, as would happen with Mr. Phillips. There was nothing done, and the investigation was not done for that, so that when she made her guilty plea at the very end, it was not knowingly or intelligently made, which is the standard for a 35C to go behind the Rule 11 paperwork. And that is where the judge erred. On the mitigators, I use that word because that's how I view a case when I start from a trial. What is the other side of the picture? What are the things that are not my client being the demon, my client being evil? Because those are also part of your defense. Those are the things the jury wants to hear.
Pardon me for interrupting. And Ms. Gowdy, I certainly understand that from a death penalty perspective, because as a defense counsel in such a case, is concerned about the penalty phase, where the ultimate issue of life or death would be at issue. But my understanding is that wasn't on the table here. So I go back to my question. Was the information that you had more important for sentencing considerations, or do you think it was more important for a prospective trial?
Both.
Okay.
Both. Had she gone to trial, after reviewing the facts that did not get presented in the record, and that we would have presented at a 35C, I think what she might have been, in a worst-case scenario, convicted of is second-degree murder, but she would not have had the stipulation to 48 years. The judge would have had sentencing available to him within the range of 16 to 48 years, and all of those factors he would have seen all along on the other side of the table, that she had been battered, that she had been beaten, that she'd been sexually abused, that she'd been mentally abused, would have been in his mind at the time. And the judge is the one that would have done the sentence. So the mitigators build towards it. Am I not answering your question?
You are. But I have to ask the court clerk, would you stop the clock for a minute? My clock is not working. Was your clock working, Ms. Gowdy?
It says 11:22.
All right.
No, I have nothing.
We have nothing up here. So what I would ask the clerk to do is, if you would please rise when we have 5 minutes left, so that we know that we have 5 minutes, and hopefully the clock will continue to work for you, Ms. Gowdy. If it does not, please tell us, and we will make sure that you get an appropriate signal.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay. So perhaps the use of mitigator as a term of art is the same as what happened in the briefing on this matter with the term duress as a term of art. Duress is not, I meant duress in my briefs in the common law sense, that someone is not doing something they were not compelled to do. But it was not in the form of self-defense. It was not in the form of the statutory affirmative defense that requires immediate danger at the same time. But duress is in the context of many of the cases involving battered women where they are the complaining victims. experts are admitted on that, to residents coming in, and the whole fact of that is to go into the state of the mental state of that person to see why they acted in a way that is, in general community ways, not normal. It is not normal that someone would not rescue a child. It is not a normal state of mind. And in this particular case, that is exactly what was not properly preserved or done by trial counsel, because they had intended to bring up her state of mind defense, as evidenced by the fact they did disclose the expert doctor, Dr. Pinto, who had evaluated her as under the battered woman, under duress, to use it in the common law sense, and that's the way of phraseology I'm using it in. And they did it wrong. Because a mental state of mind defense under our law in Colorado must be preceded under the same as an NGRI, a not guilty by reason insanity. The legislative intent, when they merged in diminished mental capacity, says that we want a unitary process. So both go the same way. You get an evaluation. The psychologist or the psychiatrist, forensic psychiatrist, evaluates you. But they look at the time of the event it happened. What was the state of mind? State of mind goes, obviously, to deliberation, to causation, to culpability. And they did it wrong. And they did it wrong on the record because they themselves filed a motion to reconsider and asked to be withdrawn as ineffective, because they missed the deadline and they did not do it properly, and they eviscerated Ms. Berry's defense. And where also we
did that occur before she pled?
Yes. I believe it happened, disclosure of Dr. Pinto was, I believe, 3 weeks before their jury trial was to start. These jury trials were set back to back. So Mr. Phillips, who actually was the murderer in this case, went first for 2 weeks. And then her trial was to start the day after the verdict came in on his case. They disclosed Dr. Pinto 30 days before, and then at a motions hearing, the people made an oral objection because they hadn't followed the process in Chapter 16 for a mental capacity defense.
Was she present when they when there was any discussion of their motion to withdraw?
The motion to withdraw was done on paper, and no, she was not advised of it. That is one of the things alleged in the 35C and that would come out in a hearing, if we could have an evidentiary hearing. She knew that Dr. Pinto had been struck. She was not advised of the impact of that, and she was not advised of the fact that it was her attorney's error that took away her defense. And that is huge when you're looking behind the Rule 11, or you're working behind the waiver of any constitutional right which a guilty plea would constitute. Did I address your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Gowdy.
You're not interrupting, sir.
Thank you. I understand your argument that it was error for trial counsel to do that it was ineffective for trial counsel to do that. But, and I understand that we're not talking now about the ultimate merits of the issue, but there are reasons, aren't there, where counsel could have been effective and have done that, right?
Could have effectively.
Their conduct could have been effective. Like, for example, that there could have been a concern that in the course of the first court-ordered examination, that there may have been information that came out concerning your client that could have been damning.
There could have been. There is none in the record. There is none in my investigation. I was also the investigating attorney for purposes of the Rule 35C, and none of that had come out. But yes, that could. But again, that is all information that would need to be told to the defendant before she makes a decision to plead guilty. And when you're facing a murder one case, that might be the lesser of two evils. When you're facing life without parole and the seriousness of this case. But again, that decision is the defendant's to make in determining to plead guilty, but it can only be made if it's a knowing decision, intelligently, and if your attorneys have told you all of the consequences and what led them to that point. The other thing that is clear from the facts that we have not had a 35C hearing on is that They started the process early. They knew this was coming, but they did the disclosure wrong under the rules. It was just plain malpractice if it were in a civil context. In this context, all I'm asking for is if it could be amended for a hearing, because a plea that is not done with proper investigation and proper assistance from trained counsel under the Pozo case cited by the district court judge is not a valid plea. It's not a valid waiver of your Sixth Amendment rights. And it is essential that this case be remanded, because what the judge's decision appears to say is that because she signed the paper and because the judges went through and did the providency examination with her, there's no going behind it. It must be a guilty plea. You can't waive your right to ineffective assistance of counsel. That's a circular reasoning. If I am the ineffective counsel and I'm saying, sign this, this is your guilty plea, ineffectiveness carries into the guilty plea. You have to be able to go behind and see the facts that led to it. Just as the Supreme Court has, the Colorado Supreme Court has recently found in the Moore case, in which they said the proper format for going behind a Curtis advisement, a decision whether or not to testify, is a Rule 35C. And they also tied that in with another case in which they said waiving a jury trial, going to a bench trial, you do it through a 35C. And that's how this is being done. And I ask to reserve, I guess I have 4 minutes and 21 seconds left. I would ask to reserve that for rebuttal.
Of course.
Thank you.
And Mr. Kaler, I don't know if this will pop up, but I will ask the clerk to stand up when you have no time left, and if we're still speaking, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Although your clock should be working.
It looks like it is, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
May it please, Court and Counsel, Paul Kaler for the people here, 19210. I just want to make sure that the defendant realizes that if she's successful here, and she may already have violated the terms of her plea agreement with the prosecution, it depends on how hardball they want to play with her, they took off first-degree murder charges against her in exchange for her guilty plea. By renouncing her plea here, or attempting to renounce it here, she has violated the terms of that plea agreement, and the prosecution, if it chooses, could refile the first-degree murder charges against her and seek a sentence of either death or life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. So every time I come here before this court and upstairs, when a defendant is trying to withdraw his plea, there's a significant downside that the defendants seem not to take into account. Let's deal with the Dr. Pintos part first. The court looks at the July 24th, 2008 transcript, which is part of the record. If it goes to page 33, and this is defense counsel, and this happened in front of the defendant. She was present, she was aware of this discussion at the time it occurred, and our position is that by pleading guilty, she waived any complaint about these matters. Starting at line 18 on page 33, this is defense counsel saying what they expected Dr. Pinto to testify to. Dr. Pinto, she's not going to say Ms. Berry couldn't form a mental state. She's not going to say she could not act knowingly or anything of that sort. All she would do is say that this is the nature of the relationship. These are the components of the relationship. This is what the dynamic is at the time all this stuff is going on and this stuff is coming in. In the people's view, that's just loosey-goosey stuff. It has no relevance to any issues here. It has no relevance to any affirmative defense recognizable under Colorado law.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Kaler, if I may, please. I've got two questions for you, because I have to be candid. I have a concern about this case. The first concern is, I'm not confident that the trial court got the law right in its order. That it said, because she entered a plea and because the court asked her whether she was satisfied with counsel, that basically closes the door. I'm not confident about that. Can you help me?
I think the order can be read that way, Your Honor, too. But the trial court also talks about the allegations here. I think with this issue, which occurred before the defendant, she knowingly waived all of her possible defenses. That's the nature of a guilty plea. In this particular case, because of the notoriety of the case, because of the Phillips opinion, we know a lot more about the factual underpinnings of this case than we would in a normal guilty plea withdrawal attempt. But that doesn't matter because we don't have enough allegations by the defendant. The trial court could have addressed all the different failure to allege sufficient facts, but that doesn't change the fact that the defendant failed to make sufficient allegations.
May I turn to that?
Sure, Your Honor.
We know from the record that there was an offer of what Dr. Pinto would testify about.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know the reason why the trial court said, well, I'm not going to let you talk about those things as far as the defendant is concerned. I'll let you talk about things generally,
right,
but I won't let you talk about her in particular. And that is because you didn't satisfy the statutory requirements of raising this at arraignment or later with good cause shown and submitting to the psychological examination. Well, thus, the defendant was denied that evidence at trial. I understand it didn't go to trial, but that is basically what that ruling said. Please explain to me why the defendant is not entitled to a hearing in the trial court to determine whether that conduct by counsel was ineffective. And as I said, at this point, we wouldn't be saying yes it is or no it's not.
Right, of course.
Why isn't the defendant entitled to a trial? A hearing.
Right. If the court will look at the same hearing, the trial court actually at that hearing actually addresses the ineffective assistance of counsel.
But again, I have that here and I've spent some time with it. The trial court says things that trial counsel for the defendant never said. The trial court says, well, you know, I've seen you before and you've done good work and,
right,
and you know, it's like not like there's any testimony to that effect, that this is why we've done it this way. The court sort of says those things. I agree with that. But there's no factual basis for that.
Well yeah, obviously, that's courts say that all the time, and that doesn't matter to where we are on appeal. But here we also have the trial court finding that the reason that the counsel did not do that was in the nature of strategic choice to prevent the defendant from being interviewed by the prosecution or an independent witness before trial. If it's strategic, it is almost, as long as there is a reason basis for doing that, it could be a bad strategy, it could be an unusual strategy, but if it's a strategy that a reasonable counsel could undertake, then it is a strategy that prevents counsel from being found ineffective because of that decision making.
And I understand that, but counsel here, trial counsel, never says we didn't want her to get examined. That's not present in that hearing. They don't say that.
Okay, well, I think that is the tenor that they did not want her examined by the prosecution or an expert. But still, it does not come down to, it does not provide a defense to the defendant. Does it come under duress? That's what the claim was in the post-conviction motions. Duress does not apply to class one felonies. And in this particular case, duress anyway requires an imminent threat of that would cause a reasonable person to only threats that a reasonable person would not have been able to resist. They must be specific and an imminent threat of injury, no reasonable alternative other than violating the law for which the defendant had been charged. There's just no factual basis for that. Nothing alleged in either the defendant's original motion. Sorry, that was from Supreme Court's decision this year, obviously. There's no factual allegations that would fit under either ground to bring in duress. This sort of, mixed capital proceeding sort of mitigating factors, that's just not a relevant consideration. The question here is, did she and Phillips, did they work together to starve this child to death? And if it doesn't come down to her and something that knocks out her knowingly starving this child to death, or something that knocks out the different requirements for complicit or liability for assisting, aiding, abetting, advising Phillips and starving this child to death, it just doesn't matter. She could have gone in and said all that stuff, but it wouldn't have mattered because it did not provide a defense to any of her actions in this case. And the question about whether the it would have humanized her to the prosecution. There's just no allegation that the prosecution would have even considered a better plea than she got. Her position is the plea she got here was about as good a plea as anyone could have gotten under the facts of this particular case.
Are you suggesting that the doctor's testimony was irrelevant?
I think it was, Your Honor.
If it were relevant, then it should there be a different outcome?
If it were relevant?
Yeah.
I guess it's impossible for that to be true, but it's just not relevant to any of the facts of the case. The representation concerning her testimony is it didn't prevent her from acting knowingly. If it didn't go to a defense, if it didn't knock out the mental state, then it was irrelevant. I don't see how it could be relevant otherwise, just some sort of, and I think, well, as you see from the published opinion in Phillips, the starvation murder of his child occurred over the course of many days. She makes no allegation that she was not, and also her allegation about the voicemail. It was clear from the contents of that voicemail that she was not with Phillips. She was home alone with the victim and his brother, and that she had an opportunity there to do something other than let this child starve to death.
But there was TV surveillance, so doesn't the voicemail show that she had to call him up just to get permission about whether or not to give him a drink?
Yeah, but nobody, you can walk out the door of an apartment. You can call the telephone. If she was able to call the defendant at work and leave a voicemail, she could have dialed fewer numbers and gotten the police and had them come to the apartment and rescue the two children from them.
So your point is there's no basis for a battered spouse situation here?
No, there's no, well, no, nothing, no kind of duress that is legally cognizable under Colorado law. And no defense that's recognizable as one of the affirmative defenses which the General Assembly sent forth.
But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I thought that the prosecution's theory with defendant as opposed to Mr. Phillips was that defendant should have stood up, stopped this, gone to the police, gone to social services, removed the child, something to save the child's life. And that she didn't do those things even though she was right there. Am I right about that?
I don't know how that was going to be presented at trial, because obviously the guilty plea short-circuit the way
sure.
It was presented at trial. I think that's certainly a reasonable way of looking at it.
That's what you just told me, though, please.
Yeah, that was the way it played out in Phillips' trial. That she was the aider, the better.
And if that's the case, understanding that duress is not a defense to first-degree murder, if for some reason the jury were to view this information as suggesting that she was in no position to act because she was at personal risk to act, couldn't that in and of itself provide some basis for the jury to come back with a verdict of less than first degree murder?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. Under this first degree of murder under which she was convicted of knowingly causing the death of a child under 12 by one position of trust. All she had to do was act knowingly. If she doesn't go to anything showing that she could not act knowingly in this matter. And even in the representations about her expert's testimony was that she was able to act knowingly. And any sort of battered women's defense, I'm not even sure how it's not been used in this particular circumstance. It's always been used in explaining why a victim did not report, or why, as in the Manuela Garcia case, why the defendant killed the sleeping victim.
Isn't this a variation, though, of why the victim didn't report?
I don't think so, because it was reporting about her. She wasn't convicted. That has to do with failing to report crimes against yourself. Under Colorado law, under the duress, you can't say, somebody was forcing me not to report, because here, that defense is severely limited and it's not available.
Isn't the standard duress case like this I approach someone and I put a gun to that person's head and I say, if you do not commit this crime, I shall kill you.
Correct.
You must take an affirmative act, or I will harm you, your family, whatever.
Right.
That's the standard of arrest case, right? This really isn't that, is it?
We don't know what was said between them. The evidence, I think, was clear. She was there by herself with the victim on numerous occasions. At least that was the way the evidence was presented in the first trial. She had numerous opportunities. There was no imminent threat, no specific... If he was there, standing here for the 2 weeks it took this child to starve to death, it still wouldn't apply. Because this is a first-degree murder case. It just wouldn't apply. It's not relevant to any cognizable defense under Colorado law. And by pleading guilty, she said, I'm waiving all my defenses. And this matter was set on the record just a couple of weeks before she pled guilty. She was aware of this. And by pleading guilty, she waived it. Knowing voluntary intelligence just means that you are aware of the crime, you're pleading guilty, you're aware of the elements, and you're aware of what you're doing. And she was aware of that. She made a deal with the prosecution to avoid the great likelihood of never having a chance of getting out of prison for the opportunity of pleading guilty to 48 years where she has a chance of getting out. Our position here is that she is still bound by the decision. She has failed to make sufficient allegations of fact to justify an evidentiary hearing. Are there any other concerns I can try and assist the court with?
Is it your position that she waived her right to assert ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, if you look at Stonewall, it says that, and I think I commit the sin of reading a case too favorably for the defendant in my brief. But if you look at Stonewall doesn't say you can never waive ineffective assistance of counsel claims. You can only waive claims that go to, when you plead guilty, you waive ineffective assistance of counsel claims going to except those that go to the knowing, voluntary, and intelligent nature of your guilty plea.
If there is a specific waiver, right?
I think that part of Stovall is more broadly stated, Your Honor. By short-circuiting the trial process, by saying, I'm pleased with my counsel, I'm giving up all my defenses, I've discussed this matter, and she was aware of this particular matter we're talking about, because she was there when it occurred, she waived all these matters when she pled guilty. I thank the court for its attention.
I would point out to the court that in Stovall, the defendant had...
Pardon me, Ms. Gowdy. I just want to make sure that when Ms. Gowdy's time is up, if the clerk would stand so that we can be informed. I'm sorry for interrupting.
That's all right. I would just point out that in the case of Stovall, where they found insufficient facts were alleged, that was after a hearing. The defendant had a Rule 35C hearing, and he hadn't brought in the witnesses. That's not what we have here. We have sufficient allegations under Rule 35C to have a hearing. We have innumerable speculative ideas from the Attorney General and from the DA about what she might have been told or what she might have been thinking, but we don't have a hearing record to put it down on the record. We need a hearing. We need a hearing to put this all to rest. We need a hearing so her side comes out. You cannot waive ineffective assistance of counsel in a guilty plea. It would be unethical for any defense attorney to sign such a thing. The only thing you can possibly waive, and even that has concerns, is a 35B reconsideration, because the ineffectiveness would permeate the guilty plea. And you absolutely have to be able to be sure that waiver of a Sixth Amendment constitutional right is valid, knowing and voluntary. The other word that was used frequently in that argument was reasonable, and that goes to the mental capacity, the diminished mental capacity. A reasonable person, of course, would not act like that. They, There was nothing reasonable in the behavior. That's part of the battered woman syndrome. It is not duress that you're standing there with a knife in front of someone with a gun. It's mental duress. She had been raped. She had been abused. She had been mentally beaten down until she thought that this was her reality. And that's what Dr. Pinto was needed to testify. Not in general terms of cycle of violence as to why a victim would recant, which is always admissible when the prosecutor brings it in, but why in this particular circumstance would someone not go out in the hall and make a phone call? Why were they such a fear? Why were they so intimidated that their mental capacity was not a reasonable person's? And that goes to the failure of the defense counsel to not properly use the process for a unitary process, which is the NGRA statutes, the diminished mental capacity. Nowhere in the record does it say that they feared her being evaluated. Nowhere in the record or interviews or anywhere in her allegations does she say they feared her being evaluated. It's part of the defense, it's what you have to do. I ask you to—
Pardon me, Ms. Gowdy. Why isn't the argument you just made duress? Why isn't it that?
In my mind, it's duress, but it is not the statutory affirmative duress because it does not fit within the immediacy. And it's not available in first-degree murder, as they have pointed out. But it is. It is. That all a battered woman comes in, it's duress. You mind, you think you have no choice. And to find that you cannot go behind the guilty plea to see what was she told about the striking of Dr. Pinto? Was she told that her attorneys had filed an ineffective? That was all done on paper. And if there is a hearing, she will testify. She was not told that the court said, you're a great attorney and you can stay on the case. And she was not told that her attorney said, we're ineffective, appoint ADC. This is a first-degree murder case, it can't be.
Wasn't she present at the July 24th hearing?
She was present at the striking. There were other issues that were brought there, and she was not, as put in her 35C, told what the meaning of it was.
I understand, but she was present when the court discussed the nature of the reason for the doctor's testimony with the trial counsel, right?
She was.
Okay, and she was also present when she heard that, when her trial counsel said, we were ineffective.
No, that was only done on paper.
If
it was in the transcript,
it is in the transcript of July 24th.
But again, there were other things done in that hearing, and it was not explained to her what that meant. All she knew is Dr. Pinto couldn't come testify, and her trial counsel told her that once those photographs were in there, she was going to prison for the rest of her life. I will point out that the district attorney itself also found that second-degree murder might be appropriate because they made that plea offer early in the case, and it simply was accepted at 5:30 p.m., while the jury was out for the verdict on the Phillips case, the day, 2 days before her trial was supposed to start. We need a 35C hearing to put all this speculation to rest, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And counsel on People v. Berry are excused. Thank you very much for coming today. Safe journey home.